I'm so much bigger than the rest of you guys. Actually, the focal length on my glasses won't let me see that far now. My brother's allowed me to use his music stand here. I want to thank Bob for his personal watch care over me, for making this year's diner a personal note. I appreciate that. Bless it. Okay. You all should perhaps call home. You know what day this is. No, well, better defined as National Atheist Day. Psalm 14 says, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." We set aside a day every year and celebrate that. But, would you turn to Judges chapter 21, because we're going to look at Ruth. And we need to start that in Judges chapter 21. Set the context. Level playing field, so to speak. Just one verse. One verse is enough. When you're reading the book of Judges, you don't have to read very long to understand. You really just want a few verses. There's a great deal that's in the book of Judges that's hard to take. Because Israel begins under the watch care of God in the manner in which he has ordered her as she steps across the Jordan from the steps of Boaz. Take her place in a land whose wells she did not dig, whose cities she did not build, whose fields and vineyards she did not plant, whose trees she did not set in place as little saplings. And into the fat of God's Canaan rest comes the people. From that point on, it's a downward spiral until we encounter verse 25 in Judges chapter 21. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everybody did what was right in his own eyes. Father, as we look in your word, I desire to see your son. We will not get there apart from the ministry of your spirit, who changes our hearts as he opens our eyes. Impart life and give us freedom. In Jesus' name. Every year, I go to a different site on the internet that has the information I'm looking for. Somebody always has it, and before that, I had a college student friend of mine who would always mail me the information. That is before the internet was available. I'm not sure the original site. I'm not quite sure where this is all tabulated, but if you punch up a search engine and punch in the Darwin Report, somewhere in the early spring, there is not only the latest winner of the Darwin Award, but also a whole litany of past events. Somewhere in that past history, about 7 or 8 years ago, is my favorite Darwin Award. You do understand what the Darwin Award is, right? This is the award given for every year to the guy that's done the dumbest thing, to remove himself gratefully on the part of the rest of us from the gene pool. Alright? Now, this one in particular incident was one in which the guy actually lived through it. What do you talk about foolishness? And I love this. You have to picture this thing in your mind as you head into the details of it. The man lived in L.A., and he got the notion one day that he wanted to be able to fly around the neighborhood and just check things out. He had no delusions of grandeur. He didn't want to be an astronaut. He just wanted to see the neighborhood from the perspective of the birds. So he reasoned that he'd go down to the local surplus store and pick up some weather balloons, got himself a tank of helium, a lawn chair, a rifle, six-pack of brew, some chips, and made himself just a lawn chair with all this stuff hanging on the edges, tied all the weather balloons to it, tied the chair to the banister on his porch, and, you know, just loaded himself up, strapped in, filled those weather balloons up with helium. So the idea was he'd float up to about, 50, 100 feet, and just wander around the neighborhood and suck on his suds and chew up his munchies. And when it came time to come down, he'd just pull out his little rifle and he'd shoot one balloon. And if that didn't get it, he'd shoot another one. He'd just gently go back to Earth, you see. Do you know how big a weather balloon is? You know how much boy Clancy, a dozen of them has, full of helium. This April Fool's Day product filled them all up. Strapped himself into the chair, got all his goodies, for real. And reached behind him and cut the rope tying him to his back porch. And he did not shoot up to 50 or 100 feet. He shot up to 12,000 feet. On the way up, he got too scared to unwrap it, and he's not about to shoot a balloon now. What if it's too much? Now, Stuart Briscoe has a good definition for that. He says, you know, the gravity of that situation, shooting too many balloons, well, that's just grave. Anyhow, he's... As he's floating around up there, it's getting darker. It's getting cooler. He's been up there for 5 hours before he begins to drift into the approach network for L.A. International. They pick the guy up on radar, and they're vectoring planes around him. So, you know, they're coming into different runways and so forth. So they have to find out what this is, because it's not acting like a bird. It's not acting like a helicopter. The blip's much too small for all these other things. So they divert a small aircraft in towards this guy, but not right on top of him, to identify what this unidentified flying object is that's coming across LA International's approach system. I would have loved to have been in the tower to have heard that conversation. LAX, this is Heavy 473. Unidentified object is a man in a lawn chair. And he has a gun. Well, to make a long story short, they actually snagged him with a helicopter. And then he shot the balloons out. And they got him down all right. But I want to say to you, as we begin to look at the Book of Ruth, ever had a lawn chair day? When you're really doing something dumb, and you're into it up to your eyelids, and you've reached the point where if the price tag for backing out may be harder than hanging in there with it, so you just tuck through this stupid lawn chair day you're having. I want to suggest to you in a not so perhaps commentative way that the Book of Ruth begins exactly that way. If you have the book open in front of you, I just want to read some verses to you. Now, you will hear Ruth perhaps a little different than you've ever heard Ruth before. That's okay. We don't have time to go through Ruth and pick out all the juicy chunks. I mean, this book is loaded. It takes 8-10 sessions to really do justice to this book. Now, you understand that it's me between you and lunch. That means I have the power. And I said to Bob, we don't go to lunch till I get done, right? He says, no, actually, we go to lunch at 12 o'clock. And the men need a break, so you need to be done a lot earlier than that, all right? Came about in the days when the judges governed. And what are those days like? Judges chapter 21, verse 25. Those days there was no king in Israel, and everybody did what was right in their own eyes. Came about in those days there was a famine in the land. Well, that's not all that unusual. Three famines in Genesis. One of them mentioned in 2 Samuel. There's another one in 2 Kings. The old rabbis like to say that the famine in Israel is the product of a lifestyle that reflects Judges chapter 21, verse 25. At any rate, there's a famine, and there's a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah who went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and two sons. Now, you have to read between the lines, and this is not going to be a Hebrew lesson. Some of you are glad of that right off the bat. Some of you know me well enough to know that we're either going to end up one of two places, Hebrew or archaeology, all right? But we're not going either place. But we do have some names that have to get in front of us, because if you just do them in English, you don't get the puns that are going on in Hebrew. Now, what's the town that's involved here? Bethlehem, Beit Lechem. Do you know what Lechem is? It's bread. You know what a Beit is? It's a house. So, where is the famine? The house of bread. You gotta like that. Alright? You gotta like that. The house of bread. And who's the guy that's running away from the house of bread looking for bread? Elimelech. God is my king. The guy who who's named God is my king is leaving the house of bread where God has promised to provide bread, which is also the birthplace of the living bread, to go get bread. This guy is headed for the lawn chair, all right? Now, what happens here? He's got a wife, and her name is Naomi. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and his wife, Naomi, went with him. What's her name mean? What's Naomi? Beautiful or pleasant? Pleasant, Naomi, okay? So pleasant, and God is my king. Take the boys with them. Oh, lovely family. What are these young men's names? Mahlon. That's the way that's done. Mahlon and Chilion. Mahlon means literally sick or weak. So for the sake of dictionary definitions, we'll call him Puny, all right? So Puny is going with Mama and Daddy, along with his younger brother Chilion, whose name means failing or pining. You know, he's just always having a disaster, you know. This guy is just, you know, a problem, looking for a place to happen constantly. You know, the head wuss in Bethlehem. That's this guy. So here is, God is my king, and pleasant, are heading off looking for bread in the middle of a famine by leaving the house of bread in the place where God promised to bless and will bring the living bread, and they take along with them Puny and Wuss. Now, where are they going?
Where can we find this
place? Please. Gratefully, nowhere. Yeah, 8 years of Hebrew. Where are they going? Moab. Why hasn't God promised to bless Moab? How does Moab come into existence? Moab is one of the sons of the incestuous relationship between Lot and his two daughters, who got him drunk and then slept with him to be impregnated by him, one of which, the sons coming from that union, was Moab. Moab grows up to be a nation. Moab deals inappropriately with Israel as she's seeking to enter the land. And Moab is under God's condemnation. So what do you got going on here? Well, it gets worse. Yeah. So Elimelech and Naomi, they head to Moab. Elimelech dies in Moab. And the two girls that marry the two sons, you know the sons I'm talking about, right? Puny and Wuss. Okay. What's Orpha mean? By the way, wouldn't you save that for your firstborn daughter? Wouldn't that be lovely for the grandparents? What'd you name her? Named her Orpha. I don't think so. Orpha means stiff-necked. Okay? What's Ruth mean? Ruth. She's beautiful. That's a friend. And she is true to her name throughout the book. So get the picture. God is my king. And pleasant. Leave the house of bread looking for bread. Under the headship of the one who says, God is my king. God has said, where will I bless you? In the land. Under my headship. Following my heart. I'll bless you so much in the land that I'll stick you in the place that is the center of the house of bread, from which shall come the living bread. You stay put, boy. No. Expediency tells me, my responsibilities in my family tell me, my lawn chair moment tells me, let's leave the house of bread looking for bread. And I'll take Puny and Wuss with me. And what happens when he enters that foreign land? He enters a land whose foundation was incest from the place of blessing, looking for sustenance. He dies there. Puny and Wuss marry stiff-necked friend. Thank God he plants friends among the lawn chair variety. You know what? I would suggest to you that Elimelech would probably justify what he did context in the book itself. He would justify everything he did by all sorts of things. You know, there's a famine. I need to take care of my family. They have bread there. We don't have bread here, etc., etc., etc. The expediency of the moment is what's generated this. When he gets there, you know, this is just temporary. This is just for a little while. How long did they stay in Moab? 10 years. Elimelech dies there. Now, who would his boys have married had they stayed in Bethlehem? Don't know, but they certainly would have been Moabitesses. God's got an incredible sense of humor. He's far more creative than all of us. The name of the man was Elimelech. The name of his wife, Naomi. The name of the two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. Ephrathites, that's a clan, who live in Bethlehem, the area, in the greater tribal area of Judah. And they entered the land of Moab and remained there, and Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. Well, that's okay. You have sons. Sons inherit, sons take care of, sons are charged with the responsibility of watching over, in this particular culture, more than many others, the women of the clan. They are the protectors. There is no safety net for the woman. There is no welfare system. There is no governmental policy. And when you have left the place of your inheritance and left the place of your promised blessing, there is no recourse other than the fruit of your hands on a daily basis. There is no support group. There is no family. There is no one gathered about, no extended group of people who care about you. You are a sojourner. You're a foreigner. You're expendable. Dad dies, and the sons follow in his footsteps. They learned well, didn't they? They marry the daughters of such a land. They took to themselves Moabite women as wives. The name of one was Orpah, the other of Ruth, and they lived there for 10 years. Both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and the woman was bereft of her two children and her husband. It's at this point, 10 years into the experience, that she arose with her daughters-in-law, that she might return from the land of Moab, for she had heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had visited his people in giving them food. Gee, what a surprise! God supplied in his own bread basket of his own choosing, bread that he said he'd bring anyhow. Who would have thought? As John Calvin would say, boy, isn't that lucky? So she departs from the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her. They went on their way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go return each of you to her mother's house. Return to your previous families. There you have a support group. There you have sustenance. There you have a future. I don't know what else is in Naomi's mind at this point, but they don't have any future with her. And that's proven in the conversation that follows, at least on an earthly level. May the Lord, she says, deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. So apparently, there is an excellent family relationship here. And these girls are not ones that are kicking and screaming and cynical and all the rest. But make no mistake about it. Moab is a pagan land that does not know the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And those who are a product of that land, unless God intervenes in their life in a very direct way, don't know that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob Elohim either. So this is a syncretistic relationship at best. There's an amalgamation of all sorts of cultural distinctives and religious understandings. And when on a foreign turf, it's rare that the foreign turf doesn't begin to infiltrate your heart, your mind. So much so that you eventually marry its daughters. May the Lord grant that you find rest, each in the house of her husband. She kissed them, they lifted up their voices, and they wept. Then they said to her, Naomi, you're different. Naomi, you're unique. Naomi, the things we have learned before you, we want to continue. We will not return. We want to go with you to your people. We want to go with you to your land. Naomi says, my daughters, how long they've been together, we don't know. Somewhere in that 10-year period, these things took place. Whether the 10 years is from the death of Elimelech, or whether the 10 years is the whole period, there's no way to know in the context. But one thing for sure, there is a track record between these women. They know each other, and these two girls love their mother-in-law. And as this scenario begins to unfold, you have the whole understanding here of Levirate marriage, as in the Pentateuch, especially in Leviticus, where the idea is, since women don't inherit in a family, that there needs to be a male heir through which the inheritance comes. Women do not inherit because women marry and then join the other family and become part of that inheritance. So it's not a sexist thing. It simply has to do with the politics and logistics of areas where clans hold turf for all time. Things aren't bought and sold in the manner in which we have them in our culture. Things are bought and sold in fashion within clans. The holdings are passed on from family to family to family. When Elimelech leaves Bethlehem, family members take over that plot. The extended clan now has charge over that because that piece of land, that hunk of property, was given forever by God to them, and they're going to hold it. Go back to your own families. Don't you understand? I cannot fulfill the laws of a Levirate marriage in time to benefit you. Look at what you're asking. Return daughters, go, for I am too old to have a husband. By the time I get a husband, if I have sons, how are you going to wait long enough for those sons to grow up, to marry them, to have kids, to secure the inheritance? This is a calamity. This is a disaster. My husband's gone. Your husbands are gone. We have no recourse. But I know where the blessing is. And I hear blessing has returned. And I'm going there. But you're not of me. You're with me, but not of me. You have no recourse there, and besides, it logically doesn't make sense. The logistics don't work anymore. If there's famine in the land, you leave the land, regardless of God's promise, to find bread, right? And while you're there, you become part of that land, so much so your sons marry the women of the land. But now it's time, with another crisis on your hands, to finally make the right decision and go back. But Orpha, Ruth, do you understand what you're saying? Do you understand what you're committing yourself to? Do you know the price tag for this kind of following? Return, my daughters, go, for I am too old to have a husband, and if I said I have hope, if I should even have a husband tonight and bear sons, would you therefore wait until they're grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it's harder for me than for you. For the hand of God has gone forth against me. The circumstances in my life are what they are, and I must work it from here between him and me. I'm not sure you know what you're asking. Well, they lifted up their voices and they wept again. And Orpha kissed her mother-in-law, and Ruth clung to her mother-in-law. Then she said, behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. What was Orpha's desire? She wanted a husband. She wanted security. And Naomi says, there'll be no husband from me. All right. I'll return where my heart is. So she goes home. But Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you, for where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, your God, my God. There's following, and then there's following. Naomi's God, you see, has become Ruth's God. Or at least the heart is there to proceed. I would suggest to you, gentlemen, that Naomi's God wasn't fully Ruth's God yet, but she saw the God that Naomi had showed her. And she didn't know where it would lead, but she knew enough to trust the guide. If you have a trustworthy guide, you don't need a map. And you don't need to know the other end of it all. You only need to follow. Follow her place to the back of to the place of blessing. Follow her back to the house of bread. When Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. Follow me. So they both went until they came to Bethlehem, and it came about when they had come to Bethlehem, all the city was stirred because of them. You know, they didn't fly in the local jitney. You know, they didn't take the cab over. It's about a 50-mile walk from where they are in Moab. You know, across the Dead Sea area, up the cliffs on the west side of the Dead Sea, and through that hill country all the way to little bitty Beit Lechem. Bethlehem in this day was about the size of the average football field. And not a whole lot going on here, folks. You know, the town center was just a small little area, and most were farmers and agrarian society and all the herdsmen round about that were in symbiotic relationship with the farmers. You know, you feed my critters and we'll fertilize your crops, you know, et cetera, so forth and so on. Much like around here. Yeah, you know, I heard a brother was that was talking about that marvelous aroma. I love that. I truly do. My wife thinks I am bonkers. But we lived in Michigan for a while, and then we came in from the cold and moved back here. You know, whenever we came back for the conference, especially when it was a hilltop, because we cut across country, weren't on the turnpikes. And when you cut across country in Lancaster in York County, oh, it's so nice. Yeah. I'm high. All right. You know, it conjures up ideas in your head that most people don't think of when that smell hits their nostrils. At any rate, so they came to Bethlehem, and what happens at Bethlehem? The women's committee meets them, right? They see them far off. Here's two women traveling by themselves. Most likely, there's no mention of anybody else. Off in the distance. Pleasant's coming. Who's Pleasant? Naomi. Right? Oh, boy, Pleasant's coming. And for you Presbyterians, oh, girls, Naomi's back. Okay? But, so they head out here. They're all excited. And they encounter Naomi. What's Naomi say? Don't call me Pleasant. I'm not Pleasant. Look at what God's done to me. I left here with three able-bodied men. They're all dead. 10 years of looking for bread in the place of God's cursing. And now I'm bitter. I've returned to the place of blessing. I've returned to the place He's promised. I've returned to the place where God as my King took me. We're right to be bitter. I've earned this bitterness. I've invested 10 years in this bitterness. Peter talks about the fact, gentlemen, that a wife is to be treated as a weaker vessel. She isn't one. For biblical submission never, never infers any degree of inferiority. It's absolute and total equality. But there is a creation order. And there are roles and responsibilities. And while she is the crucible of life, it is the man's responsibility to nurture and protect that crucible of life so that life can happen to the glory of God and the praise of His Son, our Savior, Jesus. You have your component in that relationship. She has her component in that relationship. And because you are called to headship, when you blow it, when you fail to consult the other half of your brain, when you ignore the right and the wrong of a situation and stubbornly make your way through, you drag her along with you. And she goes down too. And on a human level, Naomi is correct in saying, call me bitter. I'm back. And I'm where I'm supposed to be. But don't expect me to be hopping up and down with joy. And you're going to be a long time comforting me. Call me Mara, bitter. For the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. I went out full, but the Lord brought me back empty. Why do you call me pleasant, since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me? Naomi returned with Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law. They returned from the land of Moab. They came to Beit Lechem at the beginning of the barley harvest at springtime. I would suggest to you, gentlemen, that Naomi is not aware of it, but she has now been fully prepared for the blessing God intended all along. Her husband not only climbed in a lawn chair and cut the rope, but took her with him and the two sons. And she, looking at the circumstances of her life, is now bitter against God and against her countrymen, and the whole situation is just frustrated her to the point where she is willing to be obedient, but she has no heart for the matter. She's used up, burnt out, done in. It's over as far as she's concerned. She has no recourse. She has no future. It's done. I'm here. But don't ask me to have a right attitude. Ever been there? Sure you have. 3 short months later, what a different world. 1 year later, God's blessing is broken upon her heart. The logistics and that ogre on the wall with 12 numbers on it will not let us do 2 and 3. Another time, another place. Let me summarize. You got to eat. And there's a welfare system in Israel. The welfare system is a system with honor for the recipient, with integrity for the recipient. In the corners of the fields, as the harvest takes place, as the olive crop is gathered, as the vines are stripped for wine and for all the fruit of the vine, as all the different trees and all the different shrubs and all the different crops are taken in, there is a rule on the books, a rule that is to be observed in a society which at this point has no central government, has no central location other than the tabernacle sitting up at Shiloh. There is a central worship system, but only at one spot on the map. Everyone else has their local things going on. So each clan must take care of each clan, and each group within that clan must watch out for their own. And the Lord has provided itinerant people called judges who function more like military commanders and charismatic leaders rather than a guy sitting down taking court, you know, and hearing cases. The only one you see in Scripture that's actually doing that is Devorah, and then only in a military situation. But that's another thing for another time. The point is simply this. You take care of your own. And the stranger in your midst is your responsibility. And are you your brother's keeper? Yes. So what do you do when you take the crops in? You leave the corner standing. You don't go through there with a modern mechanized picker that cleans everything right down to the stubble. You go through with people. And the people are too, anything they drop, leave laying. And leave the stuff in the corners. And if you're especially benevolent as a landowner and a crop producer, or you know, any of the sorts of produce of the land, you make sure that you leave some behind. Now what do the welfare recipients do? The people like Ruth and like Naomi that have to stay alive. They have no means of support. They have no sustenance. They have no crops. There is no place to go get a job. They pick behind the reapers. They're called gleaners. They're the ones that get the stuff in the corners. They're the ones that drop. They pick up the stuff that's dropped. They're the ones that pick behind the pickers. Now understand something. This is no freebie. You got to work for it. You have to work hard for it. Because once in the barley crop, for instance, you want to make barley cakes for supper? Fine. Go get the barley. Cut it down. Thresh it out. Separate the hull from the kernel. Grind it. Mix it with the oil. Make your cake. Cook it. Then eat it. Yes, God has promised to feed the little birdies in the trees. But he doesn't put the seed in their mouth. They got to go get it. And in the ancient system, there is no view of the gleaner as a second-class citizen. No, no. They're on equal footing. And what's more, the gleaner is watched closely. Because next year, when workers are hired, who do you go for? A little on-the-job training. A little culling of the herd right in front of you. Okay? There is honor and respect for all people involved, but make no mistake about it, Ruth is there from sunup to sundown, working in the fields to take care of both her and her mother-in-law, and she's understanding now what it means to be your country is my country, your people, my people, your God, my God, and she's watching, and she's listening, and she's learning. And Naomi's bitterness is being salved. It's being vented. Being drained little at a time. The Lord has taken them both apart, and through the therapy of good old-fashioned hard work and dependence upon others with their eyes off themselves, He is beginning to reshape and rebuild their lives and heal their wounds and bring them to a place where they can, in fact, understand and receive the blessing He's prepared before they even began the process. During the course of the gleaning, she just happens to be in Boaz's field. Just happens to be in Boaz's field. Boaz, of course, is the next to closest relative of Elimelech, Naomi's husband. You with me? Let your ball get lost in the weeds here, okay? Who is the one who can marry into the clan, secure an inheritance, and in the process make certain as a future for these women who are now destitute? Only a next of kin. Only one who marries and gives a son to continue the inheritance. And Ruth just happens to end up in a kinsman's field. The relationship develops. Her reputation in the community is a woman who honors God and who has honored her dead husband and who, in fact, continues, when not necessary, to honor her mother-in-law, Naomi, whom the Bethlehemites love, revered in the community. They do some arranging, Naomi and Ruth. She comes home with all the goodies every day, tells Naomi about how wonderful things are and how good Boaz is to her. And Naomi says, "Now, Ruth, tomorrow, you know how that works, right, guys? You chased her till she caught you, right? Okay? Set up deals along the way, you know. What time do you get off from work? Where do you stop and get gas? Oh, hi. I didn't know you got gas here at this time every day." One of those deals. You know, the arranged on-purpose accident. So fortunate meeting you here at this particular time. You know, the neat part of that, this story, especially as you go through it, verse by verse, chapter by chapter, is the timing. The timing is impeccable. The timing is incredible. You see, the sovereign God, who is superintending all the circumstances, not only knows what is and what will be, but also all the alternatives, all the possibilities. And if you think, gentlemen, for 1 minute that His sovereignty only includes what is, you better think again, because it's not a blessed thing you can do to change plan A. There's no plan B. There's only A. Can you see God's point? Ruth was supposed to go to Boaz's field today. She went to Homer's field instead. You know? Angels, quick! This was not in the plan! Let's change it over here. All right, everybody in place. Lights, camera! Yeah. No, it doesn't work that way. Go to whatever field you want, sweetheart. But you're going to end up with Boaz. It's that simple. And you know the story that liberals try to make into a sexual encounter, when in fact it's the epitome of modesty. Ruth presents herself as available to Boaz. Boaz agrees that a situation is developing that he is responsible for, and her reputation is such that he's ready. And in chapter 3, verse 14, she lay at his feet until morning on the threshing floor and rose before one could recognize another. For he had said, "Let it not be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. I want to protect your reputation, and I want to protect mine." So he gives her a cloak, and he fills it with grain, 6 measures of barley, and she heads back to the city, football-sized field, village. The word uses the word city rather loosely. Okay, city by their standards. You know, don't impose a 20th century mentality. You know, on somewhere between 14 and 1200 BC. Okay. When she came to her mother-in-law, she said, "How'd it go, my daughter? What you got today? How'd it go with Boaz? Tell me everything." You know, it was so bad when I was a kid. My sister would walk in the door after a date, and my mother would be sitting there waiting. And they would sit down. And then he said this, and he was wearing this, and he ordered one of these, and then I said, and then he said, that oh, it was wonderful, and he was wearing this, and he was wearing, you know, do you remember what you were wearing on such and such a day? Do you remember who ordered what at McDonald's that night? I don't. My sister does. My mother does. I go out on a date, come home, Mom is waiting, at least at first. Where'd you go, Al? What'd you do, stuff? Who'd you hang out with? Oh, you know, met some folks. Night, Ma. Here's Naomi. Tell me everything. That's exactly what's going on here. And then I did it. Yeah, women are wired different than we are. I don't. She held on to the sixth measure. She gives it to her mother-in-law. She says, "How'd it go, my daughter?" She told her all the man had done for her. She said, "Wow, six measures of barley he gave to me." "I don't want you going home," he said, empty-handed. "I appreciate your attitude towards your mother-in-law. Everybody in town knows it. For you, my daughter, and for the one whom you love, take this to her. Wait, my daughter, until you know how the matter turns out," Naomi says to Ruth. "The man will not rest until he settles this Levirate marriage thing. You can depend on Boaz to get the job done." So Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the closest relative of whom Boaz had previously talked about with Ruth, he was there also, and he said to him, you're the closest kin. Come over here, sit down with us. Turn aside, friend, sit down." Here he turned aside and he sat down. He took the 10 men of the elders of the city. There, these two guys are obviously elders as well. How many you got now? Dozen. Mystical, magical 12 in Israel, okay? The 10 men of the cities, the elders, and these two sit down. They sat down. He said to the closest relative, "Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech." She ought to sell it because nobody's going to inherit. They don't have any boys. It loses its ownership with her. "I thought to inform you, my brother," he's saying, in the front of the elders, "I thought to inform you, buy it before those who are sitting here." That is, go on record, man. What say you? "Before the elders of my people, if you will redeem it, redeem it. If not..." "You bet. Show me where to sign." And Boaz says, "One clause. One sticking point. On the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased Mahlon, you know, Beauty, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance." The closest relative said, "Say what? Is a wife in the deal too?" "Yeah," he says, "can't go there, brother. Not in my repertoire. Now, why? We don't know." He simply says he's not free to do so. The closest relative said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I jeopardize my own inheritance." Apparently, there is already a wife. For now, there'll be multiple children, in the midst of which things have to be separated. Or some other thing that we're not aware of. "At any rate, redeem it for yourself. You may have my right of redemption, for I cannot redeem it." Now, this was the custom in the former times in Israel concerning the redemption and exchange of land to confirm any manner. The man who was relinquishing his right removed his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the manner of attestation in Israel. So whoever this guy is, the next of kin, takes off his sandal, gives it to Boaz. What's he saying? "My right to walk on the land is now revoked. Now have the right to tread on this land as yours." The closest relative said, "Buy it for yourself," and he removed his sandal. Boaz said to the elders, "Your witnesses today, I've bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Wuss and Puny. Moreover, I get Ruth in the deal. Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance so that the name of the deceased may not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace. You are witnesses today." And all the people who are in the court, the elders said, "We are witnesses. Done deal. signed, sealed, and delivered. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, the mothers of the patriarchs, both of whom built the house of Israel. All the tribes came from that family. May you achieve wealth in Ephrathah, that's the clan area, and become famous in the village that's in the center of that clan area, Beit Lechem. Moreover, may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. That's the founding of what became the clan in Bethlehem later. I want to run past this rather quickly. Let's save Perez for just a moment. The clock's beating me to death, all right? Boaz took Ruth. She became his wife. He went into her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, "Blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer today." Excuse me, didn't Ruth have the baby? What do you mean? Blessed is the Lord who has not left you without a redeemer, Naomi? Naomi's just catching the baby, you know? contraire. Boaz is a kinsman. Her dead husband's inheritance is secured. And now there is a son to pass it on. May his name become famous in Israel. May he also be a restorer of life to you, a sustainer of your old age. Apparently, firstborn sons still have that opportunity and that responsibility in our culture, sometimes. But in this culture, absolutely. Your daughter-in-law, she loves you. She's been better to you than seven sons, and now she's given birth to this baby. And Naomi took the child, laid him on her lap, became his nurse, and the neighbor women gave him a name, and they said, "A son has been born to pleasant, to Naomi, not bitter." That was a year ago. What has happened in 3 months plus nine? Call him servant or worshiper, Ovid. He will be the father of Jesse, the father of David. Can we finish up with a musty, dusty old genealogy? Now, these are the generations of Perez, the founding of the clan in Bethlehem. Who is Perez? Right. First baseman for the Reds. Okay. Did you write that down? You want to put that in the margin? Perez is a son of Tamar, and his daddy was Judah. Only one problem. Tamar is Judah's daughter-in-law. And she played the role of a prostitute to get him to sleep with her because two sons he had given her had already died, and he wasn't about to give a third. But she had a right to be included in the inheritance and to have a son. So she tricked him. Lawn chair time, guys. Here he is. Perez founds the clan that lives in Bethlehem. Look a little further. To Perez was born Hezron, to Hezron Ram, to Ram Aminadav, to Aminadav Nachshon, to Nachshon. It's easy to say, right? To Salmon. And to Salmon was born Boaz. Salmon is Boaz's daddy. Who's Boaz's mommy? Rahab. Rahav. If you stop in the highway rest stops in Amman, Jordan, written in the men's room on the wall, for a good time in Jericho, stop in at Rahab's Inn. Inns in the old days had more than just a clean bed and a meal. She was a madam. Sound like lawn chair stuff to you? Who else is in this august list? The Boaz was born Ovid. Who's Ovid's mom? Ruth. What's her nationality? Moabites. Where do Moabites come from? incestuous relationship between Lot and his daughters. They got him drunk. One got pregnant, both did. One of them ends up with his son, Moab. Lawn chair time. To Obed was born Yaseh, to Yaseh, David. And eventually to not the hotshot, Solomon, but to David's son, Nathan. A little girl down the road comes. Her name is Mary. The clean bloodline in Luke 3 is brought to the only physical relationship in the birth of Jesus, from his mother to her son. Dad can provide the legal relationship, but Dad came through Solomon, David's son, and in that line is Jeconiah, in whom the bloodline of Solomon was cursed. No blood right can come through Daddy, but it's okay. Dad's not genetically connected. The legal right can come through there, and it does. But the blood right comes through Mom, and David sits on the throne. Now, please, 3 minutes. How's your lawn chair experience, guys? Got any Tamars? Ruths? Rahabs? Solomon's son? Oh, by the way, who's Solomon's mother? Bathsheba. Here we go! Talk about the original dysfunctional family. You think yours is a wreck? Look at this one. Why does God want us to know that he specializes in building phoenixes out of ash piles, in taking lawn chair maniacs like you and me, and blessing us beyond their comprehension? What do I care if Boaz is a near of kin? Well, I care because of this. I've run away from the place of blessing, and all the race has. I can't just walk back because I want to, because 9 times out of 10, when I walk back, I may be coming back to try and tip God's hand in my direction. But he will bless me in his due time when he orchestrates the circumstances to bring my heart to the place where I can appreciate what he's doing for me. In the meantime, in the midst of potential blessing, I'm a pretty bitter person. I'm used up, I'm burnt out, I'm beat up, I'm done. But while he's orchestrating all this and working on my heart to soften me, preparing me to receive the blessing, when I finally turned around and acknowledged him again, what's going on? He sends into this world a Boaz by the name of Jesus, who takes on flesh to dwell amongst us and identifies absolutely with you and me as a kinsman. First qualification to be a kinsman redeemer, it's got to be a blood relative. Is this nonsense about Jesus just inhabiting flesh the truth? Can't be. He took on flesh forever and dwelt among us as our kinsman. He still is. 2 more qualifications to be a kinsman redeemer. You have to be able to pay the redemption price, and you have to be free and willing to do so. Was he free and willing to do so? Yes, and he followed through. Did he pay? Oh, yeah. With his own body and his own blood. Was it enough? Yeah. What's the stamp? The stamp of approval by God on that. He resurrected him, seated him at his right hand, and is awaiting the time when every knee shall bow and every tongue confess to the Father's glory. This one is the King. The kinsman is my blood relative. He was free to pay, and he did. And he delivered the redemption price. And my inheritance is secure. Rahab, Ruth, you lawn chair maniacs, there's hope for us, as there was hope for them. And he'll turn bitterness to incredible blessing in due time when we would come back to the house of bread, feed on the bread he promised with which to bless us, and own him as our Redeemer. Marry this one. Give yourself to this one. The children that are a spawn of this relationship will bless this world. Let's pray. Thank you for taking people like us, Lord. Walking amongst us, identifying absolutely with us, giving yourself as our substitute. But Lord, that's just the beginning. Thank you, it doesn't stop there. Progressively, you make us like you. You bless us and lavish that grace upon us. So much so, it's never stingy. It's never just enough. It just slops all over us. Give us eyes that see, ears that hear. And if there is a brother here seeking to come back to the house of bread, but still bitter, give that brother time. Help us in the village to run out and rejoice at his return. And give him time for the circumstances and your work in his life to heal his heart and to bring him back to pleasantness, that he might give forth a servant son who worships you, and he might grasp how much you love him and how much your desire since the day he departed was to bring him to this point where he could love him again, and he would know it and embrace it and return that love in like kind. Oh Lord, thank you for Jesus. It's in his name we pray. Amen.